Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Khalid Ahmed, who is a consulting editor of the Friday Times, Lahore, Pakistan. He is one of the best-known political analysts writing in the Pakistani press, and his weekly column appears every Friday in that journal. Mr. Ahmed, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in 1943 in Jalandhar, what is now India. And in 1947, my parents came across. We were migrants, and we settled in Lahore. And that's where I've grown up and gone to school. And ultimately to college and finished my education.
You became a man of letters, obviously, and I'm just wondering, were there a lot of books around your household, a lot of reading going on that inspired you?
I think what happened was that I encountered some extraordinary teachers when I was going to my primary school. Since it was Urdu Persian tradition, we still had very remarkable people teaching us. Later on, of course, the standards declined. But I think the strongest influence on me was from our Persian teacher. So we went to poetry a great deal. There was another person who was very good at geography, and I think I became obsessed with geography and took it up in college also. There was yet another person who used to teach us religion, and I was greatly moved by the way he lived. He lived quite near our school, where he used to teach people in a mosque, and he had a handicapped child whom he brought to class. And I think he was a great shaping influence in my life. And I started reading. The cult in our part of the world was the weekly newspapers, and they were, our journalism began with religious centers, and I remember reading a lot of religious literature in Lahore, which was the center of high church, in the sense that if down in the country it was popular religion and low church, the Puritans lived in the cities, and they took out these very nicely written magazines, which I read quite a lot. Then, of course, the books came, and I remember being influenced a great deal by two gentlemen who were actually debating over whether Islam should be orthodox or should be rational. And one was Abul Ala Maududi, who's now a great influence all over the world. And the other person who opposed him was Parvez, who was a rationalist, and I was influenced by both.
And so as you describe this background, it's very different than our perception of Islam today because of its apparent dominance by a radical fundamentalism. So we should emphasize this point that Islam is a place where there has been in the past much diversity of thinking.
Yeah, there was a lot of diversity, and I think that was made possible by British Raj. In fact, the Muslims have produced their greatest scholars when they were not really free as people. They were mostly reformist kind of people, and I later on became greatly influenced by this rationalist called Sir Sayyid Ahmad Khan from Aligarh, who was also a formative influence in the Pakistan movement. There were other schools of thought also, where a lot of scholarship was actually going on. And I remember being quite surprised by the variety of point of view that existed, and that there was a tolerance of the rationalist point of view. In Islam, the debate over rationalism has gone on for centuries, and radicalism dominates when rationalism is beaten down. Because the moment you go into the rationalist scholarship, you find that the people are willing to reinterpret some of the messages of the Holy Writ. And they are willing to accept that there are parts of the Quran which are historical and parts which are eternal, and which, you know, they end up somehow reinterpreting some of the early punishments. For instance, Allama Iqbal, whom we call the philosopher of Pakistan, was such a rationalist, because in his sixth lecture, his famous six lectures, in sixth lecture he actually said that you cannot cut off people's hands in this day and age. And I think he derived this thinking from the fact that there were no prisons in ancient Arabia. I am myself struck by the fact that when I became conscious, there was a lot of variety of opinion in religion.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little about your university work. Where did you go to school, and what did you major in, as we say?
I matriculated from a nearby school where we had normal physics, chemistry. I learned Persian on the side. There was compulsory English, which is still compulsory. And then I went to a very prestigious college in Lahore called the Government College Lahore. And there I did my intermediate, which is class 12. And I remember doing French and geography and Persian. And then in BA, I took what we used to call BA honors. There was certain extra courses in English language. And I ultimately did my MA in the English language. But on the side, I had done a diploma in German because I was interested in languages. And I had done up to BA course in French. I think it, you know, languages came easy to me because I had earlier acquaintance with Persian.
Has this skill in multiple language opened you up to new ideas that you wouldn't have found just in your own tradition?
Definitely, I think there was this obsession with language and the way sentences are constructed, and I was attracted to style. Even now, when I think of the English language authors that I like, they're mostly people who write a good style. And the same goes for what I picked up in Urdu. For instance, I loved Shibli because he wrote such a wonderful prose. He was a historian, but he could write very well. English came to us quite naturally because, one, it was compulsory. The other was that when you learned literature, lots of the people were also literary people. I remember that we had John Stuart Mill in our English essays. At the same time, you know, one learned what liberalism means through him. And I think that influence was quite widespread in those days. And one could find more liberals in our society then, in my early days, than now.
Are there one or two books that really shaped your thinking, whether from your own tradition or from the West?
I think there was one person who influenced me, who wrote about the Western intellectual tradition. His name was Jakob Bronowski, and that was the first book I read, an account of the Western intellectual tradition and how the Western mind has been shaped over the centuries. Then, of course, what was accessible to us was Bertrand Russell. Since one lived in a society where emotion runs very strong, one puts a lot of premium on rationalism. I think British positivism appealed to many of us, and it did appeal to me as well. Among the American authors, I remember, strangely enough, I was greatly attracted to the fiction of Nathaniel Hawthorne. Hmm. And of course, some of the poets, for instance, I remember in our class 11, it was Longfellow that we loved. And later on, of course, the circle of authors that I used to read increased, and Now there are more Americans. Even in fiction, there are more Americans there than the British.
What led you then, the coming together all of these cultures through the tradition you come from, your education? What led you to decide to become a writer and a journalist?
I was quite competent in writing, and in Pakistan it was very difficult to find a good job. And suddenly there was a proliferation of newspapers and magazines after the end of the Zia period. This is somewhere in the late 1980s. Starting in 1985, when the press was made free, I think this was a big opening for me, and I started as an assistant editor, writing editorials. Then I had opportunity to start new newspapers. The Nation in Lahore was started with me, I was joint editor there. Then the Frontier Post was opened in Lahore by me. I was the editor, and throughout, I think the driving passion was that we must be rational in our approach. That being a religious society, we need some kind of rational balance. That our foreign policy, that our strategy should be formed through intellectual deliberation rather than an upsurge of passion. And I was convinced that we act on the basis of passion. Because as people, we fancied ourselves as warriors, because Muslims have that unavoidable feeling that they are warriors rather than people of the commerce. And I was opposed to that kind of general impression, and wrote consistently to spread the word that you have to be rational. That the state should look at its self-interest rather than principles, because we found again and again that international affairs were run by vested interests and not principles, and that if you cleave to principles and you're convinced that you're right, you tend to be inflexible, and if you're a weak state, inflexibility doesn't really go to your advantage.
Before we pick up this strand of Islam and what's happening in your part of the world, I can't, since I have you here and I've had the opportunity to interview a lot of great writers, I like to ask the question, what does it take to be a good writer? What are the skills required?
I think the first skill is that you should have the data of information that you want to convey. Our journalism is more stylistic. People who can write well simply go on writing without actually conveying any data of information, and I think one should be well informed and then come to the language. The other thing, as a journalist, what I've learned is that you have to reach more people, as many people as you can, and you have to shape your style accordingly. But then at the same time, I'm also obsessed with style, so I'm a little bit different from what people normally write in journalism.
Is it hard for you to write, or does it come easily?
It comes very easily now, because I've written a lot. I've written consistently every day for 20 years, and I've written in English, barring one period of 2 years when I was writing Urdu. I was working in an Urdu magazine.
Let's go back now to Islam, and there is much concern and discussion about what Huntington has called the clash of civilizations between the West and in the case of your part of the world, Islam. What are your thoughts on that? It sounds to me, in listening to your background, that that clash is not necessarily inevitable if one just looks at the beliefs and the pluralism of beliefs that are possible in both cultures.
What has happened inside Islam is quite remarkable. I think from a period of a freewheeling thought, they have gone back to some kind of medieval orthodoxy, and Muslim societies all over the world are seen going back to what they think are origins. And at the same time, the clergy has become very vocal and very angry. There is that sense of utopia because orthodoxy is literalist. They want to go back to a period of what they call Sharia, the way the Prophet lived, the way the Prophet ruled. There is also this resistance to separate religion and the state. Therefore, there is an Islamic utopia that the Muslims wish to achieve. And it is quite normal that such a utopia is not achievable. And when they find resistance to that, and in the 20th century they found that either the utopia was not achievable, as in Iran, where the clergy actually came to power, or that there was resistance to the initiation of a utopian movement. And there is a lot of violence involved in that. There is, of course, I think it's an internal conflict, and it's not Huntingtonian in that sense. But when the Muslims argue among themselves, they usually think that it's Western ideas and Western dominance which is standing in the way, and that society has been influenced excessively by Western ideas. And rationalism is included in that, although I think rationalism came to Islam pretty early and was rejected pretty early, and it was under the influence of Greek philosophy that it came.
When you say rationalism, you mean that that was another strand in opposition to the one you've just described? Is that what you mean? Yeah.
That's right. It is a moderate middle ground where people say, fine, we can be literalist, we can follow the Sharia literally, but we have also to be reasonable about how we enforce it. In a very recent interview in Saudi Arabia, a sociologist lady said, but where is Middle Islam? Mm-hmm. So there is that crisis of somehow the moderates either being marginalized or being threatened. And I think that influences the Muslim world. And the activism that one sees, the radicalism that has come to the fore, is a rejection of rationalism.
And what accounts for this turn of events, or the dominance of the more conservative elements? You suggested a fear of violence, but what other social conditions or international politics has affected this dynamic?
I think the most significant change which has come is the independence for the Muslim societies and the formation of new Muslim states. Before that, they were living under imperialism. And imperialism was obstructive, but Sharia was not possible of enforcement. Once the new states were created, there was this tendency to make them Islamic, which is only natural. If it's a Muslim country, it has to be Islamic. Then the new state realized that as far as lawmaking is concerned, popular religion doesn't help very much. Popular religion is low church, where people live according to local traditions and call them Islamic. There is a lot of pluralism there. There is poetry. There are saints. There are shrines that they go to. But the state cannot recognize the shrine and mystical poetry as lawmaking function. So they go back to the books and they find that the only books are in the medieval times. And after the medieval times, Islam went through what is called imitation, a period of imitation, that we will not reinterpret the scripture anymore. And in a very strange way, it was the Islamic jurists of the medieval times who superseded sometimes the edicts of the Quran. And that is what the state tried to bring back. When this trend in the Islamic State started, then they had to abandon low church and adopt what is, in my mind, the high church, where all these laws were ready as case laws made by the jurists.
Now, then how does the intervention of external powers affect this dynamic? Because when one looks at the landscape, one can't avoid saying that the West is somehow implicated in the kinds of regimes that have emerged in the Islamic world.
Well, some of the charges are they seem correct, but they're also quite superfluous. I think the West. Especially the Afghanistan war against the Soviet Union, I think the Islamic warriors were helped by the West, and they gathered strength. But after that, the process of Islamization was not actually dictated by the West. That happened naturally because the Islamic State went back to old jurisprudence where some of the modern values were violated. For instance, in Islamic jurisprudence, the status of the non-Muslim in an Islamic state is not determined. In fact, our jurists say that they cannot be full citizens and they should be on sufferance and they should pay a special tax. Now, in today's age, after you've signed the Declaration of Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it is not possible to say that the non-Muslims are not citizens. The other problem that arises from medieval jurisprudence is that women cannot be full citizens, that their testimony in the court of law is half that of men, and that they do not inherit as equally as others.
So you're suggesting that the Islamic world, because of this dynamic we've described, is really held back from entering the modern world as we know it.
Tragically, because the Middle Islam or the intellectual Islam has been marginalized, the process of reform, which is so necessary for the Islamic State, has practically ceased. And I think it's very important for the Islamic States to rationalize the laws that they want to bring in. What is happening now is, since they're not able to enforce the Sharia as it is, they are also resisting the coming to power of the clergy, because they think that if the clergy comes to power, they will actually enforce very harsh aspects of medieval jurisprudence. And that leads to conflict. And most of these governments who are now holding this process back are seen by the clergy to be supported by the West, which is only incidental, because most of these states are traders. They either trade in oil or they trade in other goods that the West needs, so that relationship is there. The conflict, I don't think it is Huntingtonian in that sense, but it does spill over. And I think one incident that took place, the September 11 incident that took place, actually substantiates an aspect of what he warned against.
In what sense?
That the Muslim upheaval is not internal, mm-hmm. that it can be externalized, and that the West can actually become a target. But I think that the conflict is internal. the conflict in the Islamic world is internal between a radical variety of Islam and what we have known as moderate Islam.
And how does this conflict affect the possibilities of the Islamic world in terms of economic development?
Well, if you follow the medieval jurisprudence, then of course it is almost impossible to progress economically, because our jurisprudence doesn't allow any kind of banking system. Pakistan, for instance, now is under obligation by the Supreme Court of Pakistan to abolish interest. And that is based on four verses of the Quran, which are patently aimed against the moneylender. What our judges are not able to do is to rationalize the interpretation of these four verses by the medieval jurists, because in the medieval times there were no banks but only moneylenders. Of course the moneylenders have to be banned, but in our society, people who lend money to the bank are very poor people. They keep savings accounts. And I think the biggest crisis is going to be that people will not be able to save, because if they have saving accounts, those will be outlawed. I think that economics is going to be very difficult in the Islamic world if the radicals actually take over, because their rationale is that if you abolish the banking system, there will be blessing rather than any economic betterment. And if there is blessing, the economy will follow.
I'm curious as to how the individual is perceived in Islamic culture. There is respect for the individual and his moral choice, his ability to make moral choice, in ways that are consistent with Western ways of thinking. Is that correct, or am I incorrect about that?
I think any utopian system will neglect the individual, and I think the Platonic utopia also neglected the individual. The Marxist utopia also downgraded the individual, and that goes also for the Islamic utopia. Unless you reform some of the aspects of Puritanism as it exists, otherwise it is going to be very difficult for a purely Islamic state to observe the human rights as understood in the West and as understood by the signatories of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
How are these forces that we've been talking about, this intellectual debate within Islam, played out in your country, Pakistan?
Well, if the state is ideological, and I suppose Pakistan is an ideological state, but compared to Iran, an incomplete ideological state. If you have ideology, you are less intolerant of the variant point of view. To that extent, the intellectual does not exist in Pakistan. But since the state is incomplete, incompletely ideological, there are some people who actually express their opinion in a muffled way. But if you go to Iran, it becomes virtually impossible to be an intellectual. I refer especially to the fate of Abdul Karim Sarush, who was an Islamic intellectual, whose credentials cannot be doubted at all as a Muslim, but had to go away from Iran. The same applies to some of the intellectuals of Egypt, because Egypt had that kind of environment where the intellectual could survive, and a number of them have had to leave Egypt for fear of violence against them. In Pakistan, ideology actually forbids intellectual activity. For instance, there is one section in the penal code which says that if you criticize the ideology of Pakistan, you can be punished for it.
So how do you survive in this environment, and your paper survive?
As I said, Pakistan is an anomaly in many ways, and one reason why the clergy is so aggressive in its effort to Islamize it further, or to Talibanize it, as we say, is that it's not completely ideological. Although we have Sharia imposed, but it's a very inclusive Sharia in the sense that the charter of the Federal Sharia Court says anything which is not against Islam should be accepted. And that's a very inclusive kind of charter. The clergy would have it otherwise, that it should be exclusive, there should be a pure reproduction of what they think was the Islamic utopia of early days. I think the problem is that there is a space in which one can still express oneself, but increasingly there is pressure not to express the variant point of view. But one needs a little bit of encouragement and people start expressing themselves clearly, which has happened now. And I think after September 11, Pakistan has had to change very rapidly. And in reaction, people have started speaking differently. More and more people write more freely, especially in the English language, but some of it is also trickling down into the Urdu press. Because Pakistan is an anomaly in the Islamic world in the sense that there's a free press, which is amazing. I can't think of another Islamic country, Muslim country, where the press is so free. And in many ways, it is more free than the press in India. That there are opportunities for people to say what they wish to say. But one cannot say that there is no fear. There is fear, but more and more people are saying what they want to say.
So for you as a journalist to operate in this environment takes not a small amount of courage.
Yes, it is sometimes quite difficult. You face opposition, you face anger, because the new face of Islam in the 20th century, in the late 20th century, is that of an enraged cleric. And that, of course, is a very scary proposition. But our elites are quite westernized. They may not speak out. They may not have an intellectual expression. But the elites in Pakistan, people who run the industry, people who export Pakistani goods abroad, who constantly come into contact with the Western world where our goods are bought, are quite westernized. And that is, in fact, a great obstruction to the complete victory of the radicals.
And what are the roots of your courage, just out of curiosity? What keeps you going?
I think after 1985, when the press was made free, there are laws that the courts have to uphold. And one law is that I have the right to say what I want to say. Some of the constitutional provisions have been put on the back burner, but they're there, they can be used against me. But increasingly, the judges really don't take that into consideration. There are 10 years of punishment for anyone who opposes Pakistan ideology. Now, the point is, am I opposing Pakistan's ideology, or am I simply suggesting reform? And I'm constantly suggesting reform. I'm not rejecting Islam. In fact, I don't know what I would do without the religion, because my ancestors were all Muslims, and I really believe in the faith. I don't think that I'm an atheist or a secularist of a kind of brand that would be intolerable in Pakistan. I believe that our elders were moderate, that we had a tradition of tolerance, and that we are quite capable of enforcing Islam in its reformed variation.
One gets the sense, as a neophyte to the history of your country, that there was a major turning point in the early 80s, or in the 80s, with the emergence of our administration and the Afghan war, the Soviet invasion, and so on, and Pakistan's role through its ISI in that whole process. Would you comment on the extent to which a major downward spiral for your country began in that period?
What was really unfortunate in the beginning of the Afghan war was that our democracy was overthrown. And the process in Pakistan is that democracy becomes extremely destabilized and there are internal disturbances, and then finally the army overthrows the civilian government. And that's what happened at the beginning of the Afghan war. And we had a general running the country who was reacting against what had gone before.
This is General Zia.
General Zia. And I think, together with the religious parties, he thought that he should once and for all extirpate all secular socialist thinking. And he enforced the Sharia in Pakistan. At the same time, I think he participated in the Afghan war through an army of surrogates. And I think that was a grave mistake that we made, that our army, which in 1971 had fought with India and about 90,000 soldiers had been made POWs, this time fought a covert war, which was deniable war, in Afghanistan through people who were actually mercenaries. And I think that tended to change Pakistan's society, because these warriors came back to Pakistan and lived in civil society, and they were exempted from the law because they carried arms, and they were trained as military people, and they were also protected against the normal process of law by the intelligence agencies. That led to a gradual diminution of the writ of the state in Pakistan, till we reached a stage that the state did not exist at all in certain cities. For instance, in Karachi, we got used to having no state jurisdiction at all. But people who were so powerful that they ran the city and they also ran the government.
Let's explicate this a little, so that these warriors, these surrogates, were fighting the Russians in Afghanistan. Is that how this process begins? And Zia, in terms of his strategic concept, thought that by winning in Afghanistan, that he would acquire for his country strategic depth.
I think that came along as the war progressed. He definitely benefited from the largesse of...
From the United States.
...of the United States, because the economy was in a crisis when he took over, and the money that came later was a price for his cooperation in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, he encouraged the formulation of religious militias, headed by people who were of dubious character, but who served his purpose. And Pakistan also chose its favorites, which I think was a very bad policy, short-sighted policy, which finally fragmented Afghanistan as a country. And if there was a feeling that Pakistan, that Afghanistan should become strategic depth for Pakistan, that was defeated because we allowed that country to become disunited.
And in a way, this furthered the process of Talibanization of Afghanistan.
That's right. I think Afghanistan was most unfortunate. They had seven major Sunni militias who were then resident in Peshawar. We chose the most radical ones, and the moderate ones we rejected. And out of the seven, five were actually in favor of the Shah coming back. We didn't want the Shah to come back. We thought that we would control Afghanistan much better if we had our own man there.
And you're referring to the Shah of Afghanistan.
Shah of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
That, I think we deliberately got rid of the moderate elements, which could have been powerful during the Soviet invasion. We removed them from the scene, and I think the CIA also went along in that. I think there were many right-wing activists in the United States who actually encouraged Pakistan to go that way, and we did go that way. But what happened in the process was that as our youth went into Afghanistan to get training, they became a certain kind of Muslims, because in Afghanistan, the predominant school of thought is what is called Deobandi, which is a puritanical kind of Islam. And the Barelvis, who are in majority in Pakistan, could not go there because there was no tolerance for lower church in Afghanistan. And that started the conflict. Afghanistan is unlucky in the sense that the Taliban Islam they got was not really their Islam, because now that Karzai is in power, the first thing he's done is he's suspended all the Taliban laws, saying they're not our laws at all. Which meant that this new thinking, Islamic thinking, extremist Islamic thinking, went from Pakistani seminaries, seminaries of high church, Deobandi brand, which could not be implemented in Pakistan, but found fertile ground in Kabul and Kandahar. And now that Pakistanis complain of Talibanization, I think they should realize that the new stringent laws against women and against the minorities, they actually went from our seminaries, whom we don't accept, but they did go from Pakistan.
So in a way, during this phase of Pakistan, there were two components. One is within the government, the ISI, the intelligence services, became a dominant factor in the government because they were managing this operation that you just described. But on the other hand, there was a flowering of these madrasas, these Islamic schools, which were not offering secular studies, but rather fundamentalist studies and training the cadre to be warriors.
Yeah, I think many things happened at the same time. One is that Pakistan, which was supported by low church religion, what is called the Brelvi religion, adopted the status of an Islamic state and had to go back to the Deobandis who were working with Gandhi in the Khilafat movement and did not support Pakistan. But the moment you said, okay, now we're going to have laws which are going to be Islamic, you abandoned low church and tried to adopt high church. Now, Afghanistan was already high church, and the Puritanism of the Deobandis came because of their early 18th century contact with Saudi Arabia. And that contact was revived when the Arab-Iranian conflict took place. And I think in the early 80s, there was an area in Pakistan where the Arab princes had extraterritorial rights for hunting. And that's when our seminaries started interacting with them. The first seminaries were opened around that place called Rahim Yar Khan, where they used to come for hunting. And that's where they received the money. And that's when, for the first time, the Deobandis in Pakistan declared that the Shias should be apostatized or made non-Muslims and be accepted as a minority. That was a very extreme step to take, but I think that their incentive really was the money which came to them. This money actually increased in volume, and the jihad became a very mercenary enterprise. And we have now a law which bans collection of funds. Because some of these seminaries collect funds which are astronomical, and that gives them the power. Once you have money, you can actually buy up some of the state apparatus. and the intelligence services also start interfacing with you, not as minders, but as participants.
Another element in the evolution of this dynamic that you've described is really a refocus on the struggle with India with regard to Kashmir. Explain how that struggle became different in the context of the dynamic that you just described.
I think there was some kind of delusion in Pakistan that that we have actually won the war in Afghanistan, that it was the Pakistani warrior who defeated the Soviet Union. I think that was a very dangerous way of thinking. And they thought they could turn around and do the same kind of thing in Kashmir. But let me say that the Kashmir thing was not started by Pakistan. It started in 1989 through internal causes. And Pakistan simply saw an opportunity, and they used the same kind of surrogate warrior to go into Kashmir. And of course, from then on, the conflict became intensified.
And we should tell our audience that at the time that Pakistan was born and separated from what was then India, there was a promise on the table for a referendum for the people of Kashmir to decide which way they would go. The majority of people in Kashmir are Muslims, and that referendum has never come. So that's the background for this division. Now, the other element that we must touch on, I guess, is nuclear weapons. What instability do they add to what you've already described as a very unstable situation where the government, the state, is losing control of its society and so on?
Pakistan actually put together the elements of its nuclear program during the Afghan war, because I think in those days the United States was willing to look the other way. We had what we called then a recessed deterrence, that India knew that we had it, that we had put together at least a few bombs, and that if India attacked through its conventional army, that we could respond. And I think that deterrence actually held. But then there was a great pressure from the hawks in Pakistan to actually test the nuclear device. And I think it was most unfortunate that we, when we actually were driven by India to test, our economy was almost in shambles. Our growth rate had, touched bottom, and we were on the verge of default. And 98, just after India tested, we also tested, and I think that was a very unwise thing to do. Our economic crisis dates from that year, and we are not out of it. On the other hand, when the Indians decided, and they have this ambition, nuclear ambition, in consonance with their ambition as a great power, that when they tested, their growth rates were over 7%, and the Indian economy was doing very well. So when the sanctions were imposed on both the countries, India suffered far less than we did. And I think there was a kind of lack of realism in Pakistan. What Pakistanis have not realized is that if you are an unstable country and economically in a crisis, it doesn't really pay to have a nuclear device, because that device becomes unstable itself. And we know that there was at least one occasion during the prime ministership of Nawaz Sharif when our army chief tried to make a deal with Iran on the nuclear weapons, that there could be some kind of sale to Iran on nuclear technology. And that's a very dangerous thing for a poor country to do, because that means that your nuclear weapon, instead of guaranteeing peace and security, has become a source of great danger. And it is only now that I personally feel that our nuclear program has become stable, that the world has come around to accepting Pakistan as a responsible state, simply because Pakistan has undertaken to join the world against terrorism.
Looking now at Pakistan's future, what do you see as the most positive factor in bringing the hope to realization that Pakistan will reform itself? And then on the other hand, what do you see the greatest obstacle to reform of Pakistan, which we have described as a place where a fundamentalist ethic has taken hold, where the state has become an entity that is losing control of the society?
I think the biggest plus factor, of course most people will disagree with this, is that Pakistan is really not a sovereign state, that it can be influenced very effectively from the outside. That actually means that the international community can get Islamabad to do things which are right for Islamabad. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there is much strength among those elements who wish to guide Pakistan out of trouble. That ability has diminished quite a lot. But the ability of the international community to mold Islamabad's behavior is much more compared to India, where the international community cannot do very much. I think that is the biggest promise, that Pakistan will mold itself to a good counsel which comes from outside, because that counsel will be underpinned with economic assistance. The gravest danger, to my mind, is Pakistan's inability to control its population. Of course, it's very difficult for the Muslims to have contraception, but if they put their mind to it, as Iran has, I think it is quite possible. It is only the radical man who actually opposes it, but there is a lot of evidence in Islamic thinking that you can actually have contraception and prevent your population from breaking all bounds.
But there are other respects in which Pakistan doesn't have control. For example, the mafia underground economy, which seems to be very much involved in all sorts of contraband, including drugs and so on, which actually escapes any kind of revenue generation for the state.
There are two or three things here. One is that Pakistan has been actually a den of smugglers, but I think that period is now past. We don't have as much traffic of contraband as there used to be. The other thing is, of course, our refusal to trade with India. Although I think there was a time when our Prime Minister and Prime Minister Vajpayee had reached some kind of deal where Pakistan could trade with India without actually damaging itself. Because that trade is a non-tariff barrier, there's a lot of smuggling between India and Pakistan. And that smuggling, of course, goes on with the connivance of the border guards on both sides. Relations normalize with India, I think, and trade actually goes forth, I think that some of this smuggling will go away. The economists always tell us that you cannot stop smuggling if you have non-tariff barriers. The only way to go is to just remove the barriers, and smuggling then becomes non-profitable. And as far the payment of income tax in Pakistan is concerned, I think that that's a crisis, that less than 1% of the population actually pays the income tax. But that's not very far away from the kind of figure we have in India. There is a resistance to income tax payment. But if Pakistan were to turn away from war, I think the economy could actually turn around. Since 1998, when the sanctions were imposed on us for our nuclear test, no foreign investment has taken place, but also no internal investment has taken place. There's actually a flight of capital and capitalists from Pakistan, and that is because most people anticipate another war. And I think Pakistan has to try very hard to remove this anticipation of war. If that is removed, I think the economy will pick up. Our economy can pick up much more quickly than India's. India's is a giant economy, it moves slowly, but Pakistan's economy is already more liberal than India's and can pick up very nicely. And I think the process of globalization, although resisted in the third world because of some bad experience, will be good for Pakistan because it will also water down some of the insulation culture that we have adopted over these years.
One final question requiring a short answer because our time is almost up. If students were to watch this story of your journey as a rationalist within Islam and also as a writer concerned with expressing liberal values in a very complicated society, what lesson might they draw from your life that you would like to leave them with?
I think that one has to be culturally rooted to become a complete human being. I don't think that a Pakistani who is read only in English can become finally a balanced person, although there are exceptions. There are fantastic exceptions of boys and girls who have learned only English and absorbed all knowledge only through English, who have also realized the genuineness of their own culture. But it's dangerous to be knowledgeable only in one culture, which is Western culture. The other side of it is that if you are not knowledgeable in Western civilization, then the danger is that you will become a paranoid. And I think the biggest lesson anybody can learn from me is that if they live in the West, they must try and assimilate. They must try and understand that culture, not pop culture, but the mainsprings of real civilization. They must learn, they must go to classical music, they must learn the philosophy, they must go to the political scientists. And if they are in the United States, they should look at the explosion of knowledge in this society and the good work that people are doing. And they should also learn from the pluralism that exists, that there is a tolerance of the variant point of view. I mean, you can read Chomsky, you can read Edward Said, but you should also realize that they live in this society and are flourishing.
Thank you very much, Khalid, for being here today and sharing this fascinating story of your journey.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.